You know, we buy our boys different toys, we dress them in anything but frilly and feminine, and then this is just tip of the iceberg in the myriad ways boys and girls are treated differently. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The central question here on The Morning Show, how will we raise our boys to be different? This is sensitive conversation at times. Please take care. We'll explore it in this era when Me Too has fueled a national dialogue on what women and girls face. But what about the challenges boys face? I have three boys. Our author has a son, too. But we all have sons in our life, right? At home, at school, extended family, in our community. How do we help boys thrive? What will it take to break down stereotypes of masculinity? Conversation right here, 800-642-1234. Emma Brown is an investigative reporter for The Washington Post. Her book is called To Raise a Boy, Classrooms, Locker Rooms, Bedrooms, and the Hidden Struggles of American Boyhood. Emma, welcome to the Ideas Network.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, goodness. I took heart and comfort in your honesty right off the bat, not having the natural instincts, you know, kick in right away on how to raise a boy. I just felt that, and I tried to suppress those feelings and not think about it because I had such a strong roadmap for my daughter. Can you take us to that point where your fear of raising a son kicked in?
Yeah, I think that I was sitting at home with my son. I remember where I was, and I was on my phone nursing him when I saw the alert pop up for the first Harvey Weinstein story. And it was in that moment and in the moments following, as I read the stories, the Me Too stories that came after that, that I really for the first time kind of started to think about what does it mean to have a boy? And maybe that sounds silly, but I just hadn't really confronted it. And as you say, I had such strong instincts for my daughter. She's 3 years older. And when she was born, there's a lot I didn't know about how to be a parent, that's for sure. But I had really strong ideas about how I wanted to help her kind of resist the messages that get beamed at girls from the time that they're tiny. And I realized when my son was born, I had no idea even what those messages were. I mean, I grew up with three big brothers, so I've been around boys, but I think I thought girls had it easy and boys had it easy while girls faced struggles. And I was just wrong about that. And I learned that in the course of this reporting. I talked to hundreds of people, boys and parents and coaches and teachers and scholars, researchers. Boys face a lot of struggles and pressures and stereotypes themselves that are not helping them thrive and that are getting in the way of them thriving. So that was sort of my realization in the course of doing this book.
Yeah. And you have that as the backdrop of a much larger story around Me Too. I mean, a little over a year ago, Harvey Weinstein was convicted at his sexual assault trial. You know, the jury found him not guilty, though, on the most serious charge, predatory sexual assault. And then 2018, Christine Blasey Ford testifies that Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her when they were in high school together in 1982. How were these stories, and also you breaking the story of Ford and those allegations, what was it like to cover that as a new mother?
Well, Christine Blasey Ford's story, of course, became such a sort of political earthquake here in Washington. But my experience of it, covering that story, breaking that story, covering its aftermath, was the emails that came to me from many people who said that they too had experienced a sexual assault in high school, which made me some of them were women and some of them were men. Many of them were people who had never told anybody what had happened to them. And having already had this is now a year after the Harvey Weinstein stories, right? So we were well into the Me Too stories by the time Christine Blasey Ford testified at the Senate. But it made me realize that we have started talking in this country about sexual harassment and assault in the workplace, in colleges, but we have not really talked about where does this come from? And also, what are children's experiences And so that was part of the impetus for, you know, really focusing in this book on children and on their experiences.
We're talking with Emma Brown, reporter for The Washington Post, author of the new book, To Raise a Boy, and getting your insights on how you raise your sons. 800-642-1234. Andrew is joining us in Whitewater with thoughts on this. Andrew, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
One question I have is we've seen a lot of these cases with Me Too, where people are acting inappropriately in a sexual manner. And I wonder what the author or the guest's view on, the promotion of open sexuality and mass media, if that plays a role in some of this behavior, because, you know, between music videos on television where you've got young teenagers, both young boys and girls watching them, I think that plays an influence in how these younger people are acting out and then even into their adult life.
Andrew, thank you so much for that question. What is the influence there, Emma, of what kids are watching?
Well, you know, I think we have to think about what they're seeing in the context of their broader lives. And one thing I learned in the course of this reporting is that sex education, including just really basic topics like puberty and how our bodies develop has disappeared from many public schools between the year 2000 and about 2015. That was surprising to me. There's also research showing that many parents aren't talking with their children about intimate relationships and sexual consent. And so there's sort of a vacuum for a lot of boys. And then on the flip side, as the caller says, there's a lot of media, some of it, you know, media that's out readily available for anybody to find at any age, some of it pornography that is also becoming pretty readily available and easy for anyone to find. And the pornography in particular just shows it's, you know, there's plenty of images of sex that's not consensual or respectful. And boys I talked to, you know, one boy told me he had started watching pornography when he was in fifth grade at the suggestion of his friends. And by the time he reached high school, he told me he figured, you know, if you want to have sex, you just do it. You don't ask. Mm-hmm. And I think that so if we are leaving a vacuum for our boys and leaving them to learn from sexually explicit media, we are doing them a disservice. We're not giving them the guidance they need to have respectful relationships.
Well, when you asked teen boys what they had learned in sex ed class, they rolled their eyes at you and said, "What sex ed? Where is the breakdown? What is happening here in not teaching sexual health?"
I think there's a lot of reasons. I mean, one is that it can be, I think for schools, it can feel like going out on a bit of a ledge to talk about sexuality because I think some schools fear that parents will have strong reactions. I also think ideas an expert told me for this restriction of sex education over the past two decades is the introduction of No Child Left Behind and the real focus in schools on math, reading, and writing, sometimes to the exclusion of other important subjects. But what we know is that we can start talking with our children about ideas that are really important for respectful relationships, like personal boundaries, for example, long before we need to talk to them about, you know, explicitly about sex and sexuality. So we can start laying the groundwork for healthy relationships in ways that I think would be really acceptable to all parents.
The Washington Post's Emma Brown with us on a journey to explore how to raise her son and all of our sons, right, to have healthier relationships with women, with other men. Her new book is called To Raise a Boy. Dads, are you raising your sons differently than the way you were raised? What kind of man would you like to see your child grow up to be? How should we be raising boys differently? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Emma Brown here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the powerful forces that shape masculinity and the challenges boys face and what parents and educators can do to better support them. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is a sensitive discussion at times, so bear that in mind. Emma Brown, she writes, the pressure boys feel to be appropriately masculine obviously undermines the health and safety of girls. But what Emma found stunning was the evidence it can be equally destructive for boys. Are you a parent of a son? What makes you anxious about raising him? 800-642-1234. The book is called To Raise a Boy, and journalist Emma Brown is with us for the hour. Emma, we had an anonymous caller who said that she experienced sexual assault in middle school along with two of her close friends. And so she says institutions on this level need to be paying attention to what's happening in middle school. And at the same time, she said teachers already have a lot on their plates. It might be hard to get them to notice this. And she wonders, it makes her wish all boys and girls went to separate schools. So a lot to unpack there. What do you see at the middle school level?
Well, this was one of the, I think, most surprising and important things I learned in writing this book is how much, how common it is for children to sexually harass and sexually assault one another, and including in middle school. And so, you know, before the break, we were talking about the importance of sex education. And this is a big, this is one big reason why, because if we wait until children are in high school or college to start talking about appropriate, you know, appropriate ways to interact and about sexuality, we are waiting far too long. So I think, you know, to your caller's point about teachers, I think teachers don't often get the training that they need to interrupt, intercede when they see something going on, and so there's a lot of sexual harassment that, and even assault that happens kind of in the ether in schools, and kids see it happening around them. They come to learn that it's normal. And we don't want our kids to learn that that kind of interaction is normal. We want them to grow up in an environment where they are learning how to be respectful young people so that they can also be respectful adults. So as to the point about separating kids, I mean, we live in a world where we all live together. And so I think it's really important for young people to learn how to be respectful to one another, regardless of gender.
You know, on the Supreme Court, you point out that of the nine justices, six are men, and four of those men are graduates of all-male high schools. Justice Brett Kavanaugh, one of them. What does it mean for boys to go to school without any girls?
Well, I talked to, there's a chapter in the book about all-boys schools, and I talked to some alumni who said, on the one hand, they appreciated their high school experiences. And on the other hand, when they left high school, they didn't feel prepared for living in a world with girls, for their social lives, for even school and work. And so I think, you know, I spoke to the head of the International Boys School Coalition, which is a coalition of many boys schools around the world, who said that this is a concern for many of his of heads of schools, of boys schools. They're trying to figure out how do we have more interaction with girls outside of just parties and sort of, you know, parties and dances. Like, how do we give our boys the experience of working alongside girls? And so I think that even for schools that are built around the notion that boys thrive if they're given a all-boys space, they are trying to figure out how to integrate more with girls.
We're talking with Emma Brown, investigative reporter for The Washington Post, author of the new book, To Raise a Boy. Teachers and coaches, what do you see when you see boys interacting? What messages are we telling boys in TV, in movies, in media? What should modern masculinity look like today? 800-642-1234 to join in. Can you take us to Gunnison, Utah? You wrote about this small community and what boys were facing there. And what struck me is in one court proceeding, the boys feared that they would not be believed and that they had brought the attack on themselves. And I could have replaced the word boys with girls and would have believed all of it. What happened in this tiny town?
Yes. So this was a really small rural town south of Salt Lake City, and there was a court proceeding involving a boy, a middle school boy, who was accused of sexually assaulting multiple boys who were on various sports teams that he was on. And so the court proceeding that you're talking about was really wrenching to hear, because these boys who had been who said they had been victimized stood up and told the judge what had happened to them and what it had meant to them. And as you say, I mean, it is exactly what you might imagine you would hear from girls, the kind of pain, the kind of shame, and the kind of fear that this is something I made happen. And the point is, the kinds of things that boys go through when they're sexually assaulted are much like the kinds of things girls go through. And also, we live in a culture where we don't really think of boys as being victims. And so I think boys also feel this, shame about admitting that they have been, quote unquote, weak, or they haven't been able to fend this off. It was really shocking for me to learn how many boys are sexually victimized, what maybe in this kind of sports sexualized hazing kind of way, but also in, preyed upon by older men or women, or sexually assaulted by peers in other contexts. So by the time kids are 18, as many as 1 in 6 boys has been sexually assaulted. And throughout lifetime, 1 in 4 men say that they've been sexually assaulted. So it's just it's an astonishingly high number. Girls and women are, it's even higher for girls and women, but these are still large numbers for boys, and they still sort of need to be seen and helped when they experience these kinds of traumas.
Let's bring in Ray now in Manitowoc. Hi, Ray. What would you like to say about this?
Well, actually, more of an uncomfortable statement. I'm kind of old school. I'm 70 years old. I was married to an excellent partner for 37 years. I lost her. We, in fact, did raise 3 sons who are now in their mid-30s to 40. They all have stable relationships. What I'm saying is a message we don't hear very often. It begins with the parents. And all of these issues, admittedly, all parents won't do it, but it does begin with the parents. And kids, both males and females, grow up watching what their parents say and or do, not just the talk at the child. You got to take responsibility for raising your kids straight up. We as a society will tend to wait for somebody else to solve our problems. Well, that's a futile effort. First and foremost, take that first step, those of us that can. Take responsibility.
Ray, thank you so much. Ray, saying that we need to be the role models here.
Well, Ray is right in that research shows parents have a powerful impact on their children. That is true. And, when I spoke before about research showing parents aren't talking with their children about respectful relationships and what that means, especially in a sort of sexual context. So I agree that parents need to do more on this front. I also think that we can use help from the institutions around us, whether that's sports teams and coaches who are hopefully using their influence to influence for good in our boys' lives, or our faith communities or schools. So, I think that I don't disagree that parents have a powerful impact. And, just specifically, one of the predictors for a risk factor for a boy to sexually assault somebody is witnessing violence in his home. And so, the importance of having healthy relationships among the adults in our home is really important.
Yeah, and certainly, too, I think it also breaks down those stereotypes of masculinity when you see a parent crossing over and doing something that maybe that had been an old-fashioned stereotype that the woman did in the home. I mean, how can we do better in our child's eyes to break down some of those stereotypes?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's true, that when fathers are equally involved in housework and childcare, it has a powerful impact on their sons and on their sons' in, you know, how their sons imagine their own future lives and their own future partnerships and their own future families. And that's not something that I'm making up. It's something I've learned from researchers who study how families work and how ideas about our lives are sort of passed down from one generation to the next. So I do think that fathers can have a really powerful impact on how their sons conceive of masculinity.
Emma Brown, she interviewed hundreds of people to get a fuller picture of what boys face today growing up. And of course, she talked with many boys and men in this reporting journey. What do you think it means to be a man in 2021? How are your relationships with other men? What did you hear growing up about what it means to be a man? Be part of this conversation, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up with the Washington Post's Emma Brown after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're examining the messages we send to our sons as we teach them to be men and pushing back on assumptions around masculinity. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The book is called To Raise a Boy. Washington Post investigative journalist Emma Brown observes that while girls have long been allowed and even encouraged to be boyish, we are finally starting to rethink the penalty we've made boys pay for being girlish. A central question here: how should we be raising boys differently? Join in, 800-642-1234. Emma Brown stays with us for the hour, and please take care in the sensitive conversation. Diane is with us, a retired teacher from northern Wisconsin. Diane, what are your insights and perspectives from the classroom?
Well, I was teaching a class, and it was mostly boys, and there were a couple of girls, and we had a discussion about heavy equipment operators. And I said to the girls, I said, it's a really good option to go into heavy equipment operation. They're really looking for girls. And that really upset the boys because they felt like they were entitled to such a job. And it was just amazing, that discussion. And I could not convince them that girls could go into such a thing. And I felt like that was kind of a culture in that area, you know.
Diane, how did the boys express their disappointment or their frustration, or what, you know, how did you see that?
I gave them an example of when I was in college. I was down in Milwaukee, and I had gotten a job as a laborer, which was that kind of a job, and it was a union job, and there was a man that was also up for that job, but I had been working there longer, and they thought that the man should have got the job. That no, I shouldn't have had that job.
Emma, what do you make of this?
Well, it makes me think about how we have really told girls that they can do and be anything, which is great. I am a beneficiary of that message myself. I'm in my 40s, and I grew up at, you know, in a time when there was a lot of messages for me about the limitlessness of my potential. And I don't think that we give boys that same message. We don't always go to the same lengths to make sure that they know, for example, jobs that have traditionally been, you know, considered feminine, like teaching elementary school or being a nurse, or any number of other sort of caregiving and nurturing jobs, for example, are for them too. And so I think, you know, that is something that we, I hope that will be different for my son as he's growing up, that he will feel like just as the whole sort of range of human emotions and human capabilities and talents are open to him because he's a boy, so are the whole range of jobs. And I think that's something we can really do better at.
You visited a school in D.C. which had a man box and a woman box exercise. How did that work with the kids sorting adjectives?
Yeah, so this is this is a something I've saw actually in a lot of different kinds of communities, this way of talking to boys about what it means to be a boy and helping them think through sort of the stereotypes versus reality of who they can be as boys and men. So in this particular exercise, boys and girls were together in a room. They were middle schoolers. And the counselor would take out, would read out an adjective, and it was rapid fire. And the boys and girls would decide whether society believed that that adjective, maybe it's gentle or angry, which box does it belong in? And it was, what was interesting about it, there were dozens of kids in the room, and they, it was going quickly, and they all knew exactly, exactly which adjectives belonged in which box. And they also were able to talk about how they understood this is not actually how the world is, that girls don't have to act the way that we, the society tells them they should, and neither do boys. But they acknowledge that they've absorbed those messages. They know exactly what the world has told them about who men and who women are supposed to be.
And so it was very revealing to them to see that, you know, you even with a single word, you can find that label and put it somewhere. Are we starting to break down those labels, though, in any way, as you look at the so-called man box?
I mean, I think that there are more and more examples of parents and organizations and people in boys' lives who are trying to do that. And that is one reason why I'm super hopeful and really feel fortunate that I'm raising my son right now. But I also think that the walls of the man box are pretty solid for a lot of boys. They don't feel like there's a lot of room for them to push up against those boundaries. And when they do, they run the risk of being teased or bullied or shamed in some way. And that's, you know, when I think about my own son, I think I want him to be able to be his full self, whoever he is. And I don't want him to feel like he has to push, you know, be smushed into a box that he doesn't fit in. So I hope that we can work on, as parents, work on our own stereotypes about who we think boys are and try to give our sons the space to be themselves.
Bill is with us from Milwaukee. Bill, what would you like to add?
Good morning, ladies. Thank you so much for discussing this. I believe that boys are virtually a lost culture. I believe we have presumed a great deal about the resiliency of males and have imposed this on boys. When I was growing up, my father was there and all of his friends. I was surrounded by tall, strong black men. I know what a man is because of the models that I grew up with, and no model was better than my father. However, when I got to my when I went to college for my master's degree, I attended at Alverno, and I read an essay called How Women Learn. And in that situation, they said the absence of men was the absence of competition. And competition impedes learning. I learned fast. I remembered everything. And I loved my experience there because I went to an all-women's college. I don't know if boys' schools can say that. I don't think they're the same, but thank you so much for aiming at these boys. I taught high school for 25 years in three different districts, and I really got to my boys, reminding them of all of their sides, not to be feminine, but to learn to listen and to learn to care and to learn to express their own feelings, because in our culture, they are not impressed to do so. Thank you so much.
And Bill, I just want to ask you, how did you reach those students? How did you reach your boys in the classroom and really get at the heart of these issues?
Well, when I was teaching them theater, they got up on the stage and acted the way they wanted to. In English, it was more difficult. But I said, be yourself. And they had no idea what they were. That's the big one. My seniors, I said, we're preparing you to go off and be by yourself. So let's start packing up what you've learned. At that point, we are beyond gender. We said, you all have to be ready to be independent learners if you're going off to college.
Bill, thank you so much for sharing your story. Emma, you know, it's really fascinating to me that Bill was able to reach these students, but he said they had no idea who they were.
Well, I think when Bill was talking, what I was thinking about was when our kids are born, you know, there's some families have a tradition, for example, of gender reveal parties, because we think that by knowing what our kids' genitals are, we know who they're going to be. But really we don't. And I mean that in sort of a scientific sense. Like there's boys and girls. Sometimes there are some small average differences, but really there's so much overlap between our aptitudes and our abilities and our interests that, when your child is born as boy, like you don't automatically know who he's going to be. And I think, you know, giving our kids the ability to explore who they're going to be without sort of pigeonholing them because of their gender is really important, and will help our kids figure out who they want to be and who they are, and to give them the whole latitude of options. I mean, the caller was talking about being around strong men, and I love that. I want my son to be around strong men and strong women as I do my daughter. But that doesn't mean that they can't also be gentle, that they can't also be soft and vulnerable. So I think that helping our kids see that all of this is available to them, no matter who they are, is important.
Emma Brown with us, investigative reporter for the Washington Post, author of the new book, To Raise a Boy. John is joining us from Boaz with insights. John, what is your family situation?
I am a successful father of a boy, and I just want to give some advice on how I found helpful is to remember to love and attention is the most important thing. And then to be able to read. I gave my son an incentive, a penny a page for every book he read, and he kept a list. And so if it was 100 pages, that would be $1. But now he graduated with a master's degree from University of Wisconsin, and he's been working for Nike for 10 years in computer science.
Mm. John, thank you for sharing about your family. And John sees the power in reading, Emma.
Well, as a mom of a child who's learning to read right now, I can definitely appreciate that. I think boys, boys get, you know, talking about stereotypes and the power of stereotypes. Yeah. There's research showing that when boys are in classrooms where children believe that boys don't read as well as girls, then that has a real impact on their ultimate, you know, on their ultimate performance in reading. So I think believing in your children and believing in their abilities is really important. I also just want to say that what you said about what John said about love and about showing your children love is so important too. I mean, I've talked with boys who have said, you know, my father never told me he loved me, never hugged me. He told me never to cry. And I think when boys see that as a role model, then they learn to bury parts of themselves that are really important human parts of themselves. And so, you know, showing as a dad the role model of being emotionally intimate with your son, I think is so important.
We're talking with investigative journalist and author Emma Brown. Her new book is To Raise a Boy. Are you a parent to boys? What have you learned in raising them up? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Emma Brown here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're looking at raising boys and what this means today. When my twin boys were born, I will never forget, my OB came into my hospital room telling me that one had comforted the other when crying in the nursery, reaching out their little hand, and that it was a good thing we didn't give them very similar names to each other because they had very different personalities. And this was my physician's very casual observation, but it will haunt me forever, and it will likely influence my parenting style. Still time to talk about this with Emma Brown. Her new book is To Raise a Boy, and she's with us for the hour. Don is joining us from Janesville. Hi, Don. Go ahead.
Hi, I have 2 points, but I wanted to say, Kate, I hope you continue this segment and talk about abuse in the families and the secrets of people being abused, such as men. I'm dealing with a sad situation. My boyfriend doesn't know that I know he was abused and how he's dealing with that on his side with being continually abused right now. But on that note, the best advice, I raised 4 daughters. The best advice I've ever gotten was find out what the kids know first, as far as sitting down and talking to them sexually, and then continue to ask that question. I had 4 daughters, and there was something really explicit on television one day, and I took the opportunity to say, okay, we're going to sit at the table and talk about sex. And they ranged from age 7 down to 4, and they all went, ew, you know. Well, it was interesting to see. One thought it was just kissing with your clothes off. The other one thought it was nothing. And the youngest one actually knew what sex was about. So from that point on, we had continuing conversations at the dinner table once a month from 4 years on old. And it's funny you were talking about your little one. I just had my first granddaughter who has 2 older brothers. And we just started saying, the boys are trying to distinguish why she was a girl. And a little 4-year-old goes, well, she's like Aria at daycare. And then the 2-year-old goes, well, she's like this other one. So even at the age of 4 and 2, just start having those monthly conversations where it's not so shocking for those kids, you know.
Starting it early on. Yeah, Emma, you know, Don, starting these conversations early in their young age. And so it's not, as they get older, not something that is so awkward.
That's exactly what I learned from experts. We should be doing that. We should start young with conversations and then have them regularly, you know, not have one big sit down and have a big serious talk, but take opportunities as they arise to talk about issues related to sexuality and relationships. And those opportunities come up regularly, you know, in the media, whether it's a television show like Don was talking about, or the news with, you know, plenty of incidents of sexual harassment and assault in the news, or gender stereotypes that come that you can point out and sort of get your kids to think about and challenge. So I think Dawn is right on, and she sounds like she's done what I hope to do with my kids.
In your research, you found that kids should know personal boundaries by 3rd grade. Why is that so important?
Yeah, I think that that's one of the things that we can start talking with our kids about, you know, when they're really tiny, is what it means to have personal boundaries. Your body is sacred and you get to decide who touches it. And that means other people's bodies are also sacred and they get to decide who touches them. And so teaching children to listen to body language and to verbal language when somebody is expressing that they don't like how you're touching them, teaching your kids to accept that and to accept rejection so that when it comes to the point that they are ready to have sexual interactions, this is not a new or foreign concept. This is how they've learned how to interact. And it's important to do that young because, as we were talking about before, children sexually assault one another before they get to high school and college sometimes. Mm-hmm. And we want our kids to be protected from the time that they're small. We want them to know what it means to be touched in a way that doesn't feel good and know what to do if that happens.
Peter is joining us from Madison. Hi, Peter. What is your question?
Well, thanks for taking my call. Earlier in the conversation, the speaker was talking about teaching respect, and I really thought that was very important because that's how I started discussing things with my daughter. And then that got me to thinking about other things. So my question was, in your interviewing and research, did you also take race or sexual orientation into account? Because so much of what you're talking about applies across, you know, different races and identities?
That's a great question. And I did. I talked to boys of many different races, different sexual orientations, and other kinds of diversity and difference. And I think a couple of things. One, I think boys who, for example, black boys who I spoke to feel many of the same pressures as white boys, but they also contend, as we know, with racism and racial discrimination. And they, you know, one boy told me about, he's a basketball player, about walking through the affluent neighborhood where his school is and feeling people viewing him with suspicion because of his gender and his race, feeling like he was seen as just a basketball player and people didn't also see that he was a writer and an artist, and also feeling a real sensitivity to the nation's history of false accusations of sexual assault and rape against black men, and feeling like he needed to be very careful to not put himself in any situation where he could be misconstrued. So I think, you know, there are many similarities among what boys face, and also differences. And one researcher whose work I find really interesting, he's at Johns Hopkins University studying gender norms among 10 to 14 year olds all around the world. And he found that so many of the gender stereotypes that boys grow up with and that girls grow up with are similar. He called it a global script, you know, this idea that boys are supposed to be tough and dominant, sexually insatiable. And he also found that girls are, while things are loosening a bit for girls, they really aren't for boys around the world, that these stereotypes still constrain boys in a really limiting way.
I want to look a little more closely at punishment. You found anecdotal evidence that punishment for boys for sexual misconduct can be non-existent at schools, to very harsh punishments like zero tolerance. What is the appropriate path here for acknowledging that? And in what does, you know, restorative justice look like? What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I think there has been a long time of schools overlooking or dismissing or just not being equipped to handle sexual harassment and assault. And so it has gone kind of swept under the rug at many schools. And I write in the book about one situation where a boy, where it sort of seems a bit the opposite, that recently some schools may be sort of really dropping the hammer when boys behave inappropriately. And I think that both of those extremes leave something to be desired and are not particularly helpful for either boys or girls. And so I profile in the book a program here in Washington, D.C., run by our prosecuting agency, a restorative justice program that has boys or any, you know, any young person, any juvenile who's accused of certain crimes, instead of going through the traditional prosecution where they are encouraged, you know, often to plead not guilty, to not take responsibility. The idea is you sit with the victim and you acknowledge and admit what you did and how you hurt that person. You listen to them speak about what you did and how you hurt them. And then you come up with a plan to repair that harm. And, you know, it's a powerful, powerful thing for boys to take responsibility for what they've done and how they've hurt. And I think that it's a way for boys to learn how to do better and learn not to make the same mistakes next time.
Emma, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Emma Brown is an investigative reporter for The Washington Post, author of the new book, To Raise a Boy, Classrooms, Locker Rooms, Bedrooms, and the Hidden Struggles of American Boyhood. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.